Alan Kring Productions presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 1 for Autumn Semester 2016. Lecture 26, delivered on December 8, 2016. The title of this lecture is Review for the Final Exam.
Today, review for the final exam. Now, the final exam is 7 questions. You answer 5 of them. So each one is actually worth less as far as full points go. Each one would be a 20-pointer, 20% of it. And that means that 5 of the points will be for the construction of your answer, grammar, punctuation, appropriateness of spelling, and all that, and then 15 points for the content of your answer. So one thing that you notice on those exams, that 1 and 2, I don't know if you noticed it, but if you blow a question, that's a real killer on your score for it. You know, you miss one question, that's 25 points right there, or 20 points gone right there. So the damage from blowing one question isn't as severe, although you'll probably find that on this exam, it is... You're going to be more familiar with a lot of the material. Now, I pull 3 questions from exams 1 and 2. Straight up, 3 questions from exams 1 and 2. They are, yeah.
Is it 3 questions for each of them?
No. 3 questions total. Okay. Total of 3 questions. Now, they are questions that are core objectives of the course. Go. You better believe it. I copy and paste it. I just copy and paste it. I'm lazy. Okay. No, but there is method in my laziness here. Is those are core objectives of the course. Thinking about things like risk and return, capital structure, capital budgeting, decision making, things of that nature. What are interest rates? So in other words, that would be reaching questions that I had already touched as objectives. So on the final exam, I can go back and evaluate them, and then show our accreditation agencies and all of those. Here were the objectives that were set forth. Here, they did them. I can prove that you actually learned. That's a big thing, as I told you. This, what is it? Achievement of assurance of learning is a big, big buzz term now. So I can assure learning. I can say, see, here's an objective. Here's a final. They hit the objective. 88% of them did. Or in your case, 95%, or if you're all bright and chipper and all that. Okay, and then 4 questions of the 7 would be on material I've covered. Probably it would be very likely they would have come from the question bases that I gave you for exams 1 and 2. But I'll also touch at least one question that will have to do with the material since exam 2. That material had to do with capital structure. So let me be clear about it right now. You need to know what I mean by capital structure. You need to know what is the order of cost of capital from the least expensive to the most expensive. And you need to know why some of this, why capital has its relative cost. So in other words, I might ask you, why is debt cheaper than equity? There are 2 reasons. You have to give me both reasons. Let me be clear about that. There are 2 reasons. If I said, why is debt cheaper than equity, you would have to give me both of the reasons for that. I got to write a note to myself. I could also ask you, what is meant by capital structure? And what does optimal capital structure mean? I could give you a two banger in that one. In one question, I could cover what I talked about in capital structure. What do I mean by capital structure? And what do I mean by optimal capital structure? So I could ask you that straight up. Now, you might notice that if you look at the syllabus, you will see that capital structure is one of the core objectives of this course. And that's the last thing that I covered. So you might pretty well bet that I'm going to hit something on capital structure. Okay, now, let me get to some other questions. I'm going to just go through. You need to look at those question bases that I gave you for exams 1 and 2, and I'm going to hit the highlights of them. And then you can ask me questions after that. And as I've done before, I'm straight up with you. If it's not going to be on the exam, I'm going to say, no, I'm not going to ask that, okay? And again, some of them are going to be verbatim from the exams 1 and 2, and then there will be some new questions based on the old material. Okay, first of all, what is the relationship between risk and return? What is the relationship between risk and return? Now, you got to be careful because your answer is going to be short, but you can't just say risk and return. There's specific kind of risk that we care about, and there is a specific kind of return we care about. Now, I'm going to come back on a question that is core and that you stumbled on a little bit, so I'm going to try to make sure that you understand it this time. What is the difference between accounting cost and economic / financial cost? Distinguish between economic cost and accounting cost. Now, you got to hit it on the button. You got to say, these are accounting costs. These are economic costs. They are different. They are not the same. You got to be very explicit about it. This is an accounting cost. This is not a cost that we really care about much in finance or accounting. Or economics, I'm sorry. So you remember some of those costs. You remember, can you give me a cost in... can you give me a cost in accounting that we don't really give a toot about in finance? No, you got it exactly backwards. Yeah. Got one? Yeah, go ahead. Is for what?
Economic.
That's an economic cost. It's not an accounting cost. What's an accounting cost? It's not an economic cost that we really care about. Go. Historical cost. We have to use it because that's all they put on the financial statements, but that's really not what matters to us. Now, let me hit you. Is it future cost that we care about in economics and finance?
Yes.
Okay, your answer is not exactly. It's expected future cost because we can't know the future. You have to always say that expected. And that goes with that risk and return question, too. Don't forget to put the word expected. Don't give me an excuse to take 5 points off your answer because you missed one stupid word. I know that irritates the heck out of you when I do that, but it's that tightness. I can't protect you. I got to prepare you for the real world where one word can really blow an answer or cause a lot of trouble. So if you're talking about something that is going to happen, say expected. And that covers your butt in the workplace too, because you can say, well, they say, well, your results were wrong. No, I told you the expected, the projected. So they can't say, well, you told us it was going to be this. No, I said this is the expectation. Okay, so no cost in accounting, no cost in economics. Know the difference and be able to say those differences succinctly in two sentences or one. Complete sentences. Okay, and that's just such a core objective. Now, I'm going to go back through here real quick. I'm just going to put the final up on the overhead for you. No, I'm not. Distinguish between systematic and unsystematic risk. Don't forget to include the whole thing. One of them you can get rid of, one of them you have to keep, but one of them carries with it something we really, really care about. The other one doesn't have that quality. So you have to make sure that you distinguish between them in that complete way. If you just told an investor, systematic risk, you can't get rid of that, but unsystematic risk, you can get rid of that, a lot of investors are going to say, okay, so I'll have some unsystematic risk. Who cares? But then if you get them to the point where you explain to them that unsystematic risk is not going to get you anything, there's no expected return with it, you're bearing risk for no reason other than that you are lazy and stupid, then suddenly they pay attention to portfolio diversification and your talk about that. So make sure that you cover the whole thing. Make sure you know the components of the risk premium. What is an interest rate? What are its components? What is the risk premium? What is the beta of a stock? I want you to make sure you know what's the beta of a stock mean. And you got to include the whole thing. It measures a specific kind of risk relative to a specific thing. And you got to give me both parts of that. Now, I'm going to touch on a few, something to do with debt and something to do with equity. Now, the typical question that I would hit you with on debt would be of the kind like, all other things being equal, what happens to the price of a bond as the spread between yield and coupon increases? All other things being equal, what happens to the price of a bond as the spread between coupon and yield increases? Now, for God's sake, put this down. Don't. Your answer will be wrong if you say the price goes up or the price if you say the price goes up. That would be a completely wrong answer. If you say the price goes down, that would be a completely wrong answer. You would lose all of the points. But if your answer included about the price going up or down, then you're on the right track to a correct answer. I see people, duh. Again, here's what I've seen over the years. I ask the question, all other things being equal, what is the relationship between the price of a bond and the spread between yield and coupon? The answer that I've seen that it will kill you is, well, the price goes up. Or you'll say the price goes down. Seen it too many times, and I'm trying to send a warning signal to you. Don't say that. The answer has to do with the price moving, but it doesn't, it's stating, well, it goes up, or stating it goes down is not correct. That's about as much as I'm going to help you with that, but I'm trying to flag you so that you don't lose all those points through just not thinking about what I'm asking. In other words, look, suppose that the yield and the... Let me ask this. Let me try this. And I know I'm probably reaching this way old material. Madam, if the yield and the coupon are the same on a bond, what do you know about the price?
Isn't that as, like, the price versus
No. You're trying something completely different. Okay. Are you a golfer? No. Okay, we're going to make you a golfer for a while. You know, the next Tiger Woods, okay? You find your love on Craigslist. Okay. No. Whoa. He has three shots. He took one. Whoa. Okay, he takes two and he gets close to the cup. And it goes in on the third shot. He got what for that hole? Huh? What was it? Yeah. What did you just say? What was that word?
Par.
You're right. You got the answer right. If the coupon and the yield are the same, the bond sells at par. Okay? If the coupon and the yield are the same, the bond sells at par. But as the coupon and the yield separate, something happens. You don't. I'd have to tell you which way they were separated. Is the yield going above the coupon or is the yield going below the coupon? I'm not saying that in the problem. I'm just asking you what happens to the price if the coupon and the yield start to pull apart from each other. So you didn't get it in three. It was a par three. I don't know what you got. You could have gotten a birdie or a bogey. If you'd gotten it on the first shot, I guess that would have been an eagle. If you got it on, like me, on 12 shots, that'd be a quadruple. Or on five or six or seven shots, that'd be a big bogey. But okay, the thing though is, you don't know what happened, but you do know something happens to the price. You know something happens to the price. That's what I'm looking for you to tell me. I can't give you any more on it, but I'm trying to telegraph a punch to you so that you can survive this round. Okay, now, I'm going to ask you something about residual claim and prior claim on the assets, on the free cash flow. Something along the line of who has the residual claim, who has the prior claim. Or I could just ask straight up in a manner like, what does it mean that the shareholders have the residual claim on assets of the firm? And you answer that, don't talk about bankruptcy. This is about a going concern, although bankruptcy would come into play. But the going concern means that we're talking about living corporations, that the debt holders must be satisfied in a timely manner before shareholders can claim cash flows. Frame it in that way. That's not exactly what you should say, but that's a good approximation. Frame it in terms of who has to be paid first. And don't say paid off. No, you're paying in a timely manner. Those bonds are going to last you sometimes 30 years, 50 years. So you're not going to pay them off right away, but you pay them in a timely manner. And if you do that, then what's left every quarter, every year, belongs to the owners of the corporation in that way. So frame it so that you are showing me that you understand that the stockholders have claim on asset on cash flows and assets only after debt holders have been paid in a timely manner. Watch it with this question. There's one thing that'll lose you some serious points. And I've seen this before. I'm trying to telegraph what I've seen before. I've had people say, well, after the debt holders have been paid, then the stockholders and bondholders can be paid. Do you see why that loses major points? Because the bondholders are debt holders. You're showing me that you don't understand that the bondholders are over there. They are the supremo debt holders. They're not part of the stockholders, okay? And don't worry about distinguishing between preferred and common equity in that question. Just talk about equity, the equity holders. Okay. Okay, I'm going to throw at least one or two gimmies that are very easy to handle, okay? Watch out. Sometimes one that looks hard is easy. Sometimes one that looks easy, you might want to have to put more into it. And that's just the way life itself is. But I'll ask you one like, what is liquidity? What is flight to quality? Well, hell, I mean, what is optimal capital structure is a gimme. What is capital structure and what is optimal capital structure? Those are both just definitionals. They're not really tough questions much. What are the three types of money? Something like that. Don't say M1, M2, M3. No, I'm talking about barter, commodity, and fiat. And if you want to be impressive, you can also add the fourth one, which is what? Yeah? What are they called? What's the cryptocurrencies? They're called cryptos. The cryptocurrencies. There's some real weird stuff going on out in that world, good people. That's your problem to deal with that. I'm going to knock you dead with one. You can actually avoid it if you want, but I'm going to put in one at least more thought question. And I actually already told you about these. Fund managers featured and praised on the Financial News Network because he had the highest portfolio return among all fund managers last year. Why should his achievement not impress you? I could very well ask that. Because if there's anything else I want you to have coming out of this class is a cynical, dark view of the world like I have. You're my children. I want you to be the spawn of darkness. So when you see some happy face on Financial News Network saying, well, this guy got the highest return last year, I'm the one who says bullshit. And it's the same thing that I do upstairs when we have these funds. We have two different classes you can take where you manage a portfolio. Well, these kids got a 25% return last year. I'm not impressed. You haven't told me something that I really want to know that about this. And it has to do with two things. One, total volatility, and two, non-diversifiable risk. If someone comes to me bragging about his incredible portfolio, he got a 30% return last year, and I look at that portfolio, and he's got the kind of volatility that is just insane, I'm not impressed at all. He took insane risk that he didn't have to. Even if he had exactly the risk associated with that expected return. Let's say that on the security market line, a 30% return would require a beta of 2.9. So I could find the beta of his portfolio and it says 2.9. Well, he's done a good job. He didn't take on non-systematic risk, okay? You understand? He didn't take on non-systematic risk. I'm impressed by that. But I'm still not impressed by what he did. I'm not impressed at all by what he did. Why not? For that risk level, yes. You see, if you can beat me, I drive a little Mazda 3, and I got a Ferrari that comes up against me, and he beats me in a race between lights. La-dee-da. You've got a Ferrari. Of course you'll do that. You took a beta of 2.9. Of course you'll do that. I'm not impressed. Show me that you can do something with that, with my car or a car that it shouldn't be able to do, and then you'll make my heart warm and my pants damp. God, you're going to do evaluations today. Do you understand what I'm saying, though? Is that don't try to impress. You got a high return. Good for you. Did you take on non-systematic risk you shouldn't have? Well, that really is going to, that's a paddling. But if you, even if you didn't take on non-systematic risk that you shouldn't have, even if you're right on the security market line, congratulations. You took on a high risk to get a high expected return. Welcome to the universe. You did it right. Now, go wear those big boy pants when you go out there in the real world and do that every year for the rest of your life, and then I'll be impressed. We had many, many stories of soldiers who got one kill in combat, and they say, look at what I did! And the next thing that happened was there was a bullet through them, and they died. Don't be impressed by 1 year. One trick pony doesn't do me good. You see, that's in the world of investment. We talk about consistency and appropriateness. When you are investing for other people, you invest appropriately to their circumstances. You don't take on abnormal risks for your clients unless they are the kind who merit that, who can handle that. And the other thing is the consistency. As you, a mature portfolio manager doesn't go crazy, doesn't do wild things, doesn't do the unexpected. They stay a course of buy and hold over a long period of time. Okay, you got to summarize that in an answer. Okay, the other one was, on a financial news show, the talking head shows the price chart of a stock and notes the considerable and obvious price volatility. He says this is clearly a risky stock. Why might he be completely wrong? Again, I'm probing risk. You see a lot of price volatility and you say this is a risky stock. It's got a lot of price volatility. No, that's not correct. That's probably, remember what I told you. I mean, I can show you stocks that have insane volatility, but they actually have betas that are fairly low. Microsoft is one of those. It's got quite a bit of volatility, price volatility, but the stock itself is quite, has a quite safe beta. The same is true for a lot of companies. We see their price volatility and we think, well, that's a very, very scary stock. Not necessarily, because we don't care about volatility. What is it we care about? Volatility has two pieces. Okay. Let me go back to... Madam, when you are at a party, and that's the only place I know you, when you're in class, that's where I know you, you're a very calm, quiet person. When you are alone, you commit axe murders. That's not my problem because I don't see you there. So the craziness of your behaviors outside of my purview is irrelevant to me. When I look at a stock, the only thing I care about is how does that stock behave in a well-diversified portfolio. I don't want to see what that stock does naked, jumping up and down, bouncing around, twerking, and all that. Because I can guarantee you a lot of stocks are going to do that. Stocks are volatile. But you put them in portfolio, that's what tells me what to do. I've known, in my world, my God, especially in consulting, I knew people who were just insane mofos, or people, when they were out there, you know, in their partying or doing crazy stuff. And I mean, Lord knows, I just sit there saying, I can't believe I'm here. Please, God, take me away. But then you get them in that business setting, and just suddenly, they are the consummate international, professional business people. I mean, it's just, there's this multiple personality thing. And this goes for stocks too. Don't look at the stock on its own. Look at the stock and what it does when it's supposed to be performing. And that's all that matters. I see price volatility. I don't care. You show me what its behavior is in a well-diversified portfolio, and then I know whether or not that's worth my investment dollars. Okay, it's your turn. Ask me questions. Do you have anything at all? Yeah, go ahead.
What is the relationship of rising and falling interest rate to the value of
could be Wabbit. What is the value? Will you repeat the question? I'm still not quite on my game here. Okay. What is the relationship between rising and falling interest rates and values of projects? Okay, look. Let me ask you this. I've got a cash flow of $100 coming to me next year. Now, as far as the present value, what happens to the present value if I discount at a high interest rate? It goes down, right?
Yeah.
But if I lower the interest rate, what happens to the present value of that $100? It goes up. So in other words, when we look at interest rates going out into the future, as interest rates rise, the present values of future expected cash flows go down, which means we're more likely to say no to a project. But if interest rates are falling, the present value of future expected cash flows rises because you're not discounting them at such a severe rate. This is the most common way that we go into recessions is when interest rates start to go up. Businesses, they simply reject more projects because the net present values have gone down. And that's something that concerns me over the next 4 years, because we're going to have a war. The Fed needs to raise interest rates, but it had been putting it off because it had incentives to keep interest rates low, to keep the economy cruising. The Fed has pretty much lost all of its incentive to keep interest rates low now. The Fed will start to raise interest rates, and it will start to do it aggressively. Part of that is economic necessity. Part of it is political vengeance. And we'll see who is whose daddy at the end of it. But at the same time, that means that if interest rates start to go up, the economy is going to start to slow down because fewer new projects will be accepted. And that means that you will have less business activity. Business activity will slow down. And then we could slide into recession rather, and because our financial system is so daggone precarious right now, and it will be for decades to come, any kind of a minor downturn could turn into something really worse than you want to know about. So there you go. Bright future for you guys, Yahtzee and all that. What else? Any other questions? Yes. Okay. If liabilities have been satisfied, you've paid your bills for the month, you've paid your bills for the quarter, you've paid your bills for the year. All of your debt holders are satisfied. You've paid your light bill, your internet bill, you've paid your salaries and your wages, you've paid all of your shipping costs, you've paid your lease and rent or whatever, you've paid your coupons on your bonds that you have outstanding. You got money down there at the bottom line. It belongs to the shareholders. There's two things you can do with it. Any guesses as to what those two things are? What is it? You can pay a dividend or reinvest the money back into the company. You can pay dividends or you can reinvest. Now an extension of that. What is the upside of paying a dividend? Say it.
Loyalty.
Yeah. Your shareholders are going to love you. They're going to be nice to you. I mean, I told you the very first or second class, what happens when you face shareholders who've never gotten a dividend? Oh, they are nasty human beings. I mean, that one woman, as she was turning into Cthulhu right in front of me, you know, Medusa, why are you not paying us dividends? Snakes were hanging out of her hair and everything. Okay, yeah, you don't pay those dividends, you're going to have a lot of bitchiness. What's the downside of paying dividends? Yeah, the money doesn't go. Now, what does reinvestment theoretically do?
It can generate more profit in the future.
Exactly. More. We like to use free cash flow. Okay, that sounds more. Okay, you've got accountants, and then you've got finance people. Now, accountants. Finance people, yo, free cash flow. Okay, free cash flow. And the funniest thing about this is that when you do a real business, I actually have never seen profit running any of my businesses. And this one is marginally successful. But in the real world, the word profit doesn't really mean anything to me. The question I have is, okay, I paid my bills. Do I have money for Denny's? Okay, I paid my bills. Can I buy some new racks to put my artwork on at the shows? It's this thing where, I mean, the word profit doesn't really enter into our understanding. It's how much money is still there after I've paid all my bills. That's what we mean by that term free cash flow. It's a living thing. It's the actual money in your bank account, as opposed to things. And don't get me wrong, I'm not trashing accounts. They have to do what they have to do. That's their job. Thank God they do it. But in my business, in our business world, free cash flow, it's just, can you make it to the next pay period? When I ran another business some years back, my God, the biggest thing in the world was being able to meet payroll. That 2-week cycle. I met that, and then there was some money left. Literally, that meant that I could go to Denny's and have something to eat. If there was no money left, then I was hoping I had some beans and weenies at home. So there you go. That's kind of what I mean by that free cash flow concept. Profit really doesn't mean a whole lot to us in business, other than to our shareholders and investment bankers. They look at profit all the time. But to the life and death of a company, it's like that one guy, turnaround specialist, they pointed him, I told you this, this new CEO, he's a turnaround specialist. He said to the board of directors, gentlemen, I can make sure that you have this company has a profit every year until we go out of business. Because the profit isn't what's going to make you survive in the long run. Ask Caterpillar about that. You have any other questions? Thank goodness, I'm running out of steam here. Take them up to the finance office on the fourth floor and give them to the secretary in there. And as for you, I will see you at the final. And remember what I've told in my Business 100 classes, I'll tell you the same thing. Keep your heads down and your fangs out. That's all I have for you today and for this semester. I thank you. Elvis has left the building. Thank you. Knock it off.